It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 7th of March, 2015. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning with the support of the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 7th of March, I talked to David Soule from the Our Waiheke campaign, I spoke to the opinionated islanders Alan Knight and Alex Stone, and I played a talk from the Why Talk series from Paul Bond. Last month on Island Life, I spoke to John Mewson from the Waiheke Local Board, but he was speaking in his capacity as a private citizen, and the idea that that he thinks was worth pursuing of looking about whether Waiheke can withdraw from Auckland City and pursue its own path in terms of local governance. So we had to talk about that, and that process seems to be gaining some momentum. There's been a couple of public meetings. There's a Facebook page. Well, everything's got a Facebook page, but, you know, there's one of those, Our Waiheke, and people are starting to look into the process. One of the people who's got behind that campaign and is doing some of the work to investigate how this process might work if it was to go ahead is David Soule. And so if you want to know about Our Waiheke, you better call Soule.
Thanks, Chris.
I had to get that in there. So you must hear that joke.
Well, to be honest, I haven't. That's the first time somebody said it to me, but I was a great fan of Breaking Bad.
Yeah. So Our Waiheke. So do you maybe just if we start off with, you know, I mean, the group, I mean, what is it? Is it just a few people who are pursuing a particular idea, or is it you've formed yourself up into a proper lobby group? What's happening?
Well, at this stage, it's a working group. So, you know, the first step in the process is to actually look at the feasibility. So there's a lot of information needs to come in, budgetary information. There needs to be information on the feasibility if we have the right resources to do it for ourselves. And then on top of that, we need to know if the people of Waiheke want it, because it can be the best idea in the world. But if there's no desire for it, if everybody's happy with the status quo, we're not going anywhere.
Yeah, and I suppose that's part of it, isn't it? Is that comparison? Yes, there's a whole lot of things to investigate, but you can't kind of assume that you have got that weight behind you. And I mean, you've been asking for questions and feedback. What kind of response have you been getting?
Good response. I mean, you know, many of the questions were predictable. Things like, what will happen to my rates? You know, will we lose various services like the library and everything?
The library seems to be a big one, doesn't it? I've looked at the questions online and there's a lot of concern about that.
Exactly. And there isn't really any concern because, you know, we'd have to pay for the services of the library in the same way that many other small communities would. So that would be something that would be budgeted into it. But we don't see any change in the way the library would be run or in the way that the Ostend Free Library would be run. So, you know, there isn't really a problem, but they're all details that need to be nutted out in a future proposal.
I must say, I did, reading the questions and some of those things, and, you know, as I say, there were questions about the library and, you know, and as you say, some of the responses going, well, look, that's okay, it's already there, we can just buy the service. The response did seem quite optimistic, given the trouble we have getting services out of Auckland City, being part of Auckland City, that there was kind of a, yeah, it'll be no problem when we're not part of Auckland City.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but I think one of the motivations for us moving forward is the problems that we do get getting services out of Auckland City. You know, one of the concerns that regularly comes up is that how much money do we spend in rates, how much do we contribute in rates, and how much do we get returns in terms of services from Auckland City? And that's a difficult question for a number of reasons, not least that it's difficult to get any information out of Auckland City. They keep falling back on the old chestnut of commercial confidence to stop you getting that information. But it's also difficult because of the cost of those services. Because, you know, if you get a job done by Auckland City, it comes fully costed. You pay for the overheads. You pay for the 11,000 staff across the water. You pay the $610 million that they pay each year in administration fees. So it's one way to look at things and say, well, you know, we're contributing $21 million and they're contributing $22 million back. But is it cost-effective contribution back? And that's the thing. Other communities have no problems with the library services. It's not something that's new, but all of that will need to be budgeted.
So one of the things that also seemed to me, looking at the questions that have been put up there, and if you want to have a look at these and you're on Facebook, just look for Our Waiheke and you'll see them there, are some of the expectations people have of local government and what it concerns. You know, there's questions there about, will this affect the running of Explore ferries? Will this impact on my gold card? So, I mean, people seem very confused about what is in the kind of that area of local governance and what isn't.
Yeah, and I think people are a little bit confused as well about what Our Waiheke is setting out to do. Our Waiheke is looking at the democracy. Can we bring the decision-making closer to the people of Waiheke? It's not making any comments on what those decisions are. So we'll help. We're exploring whether we can build a new democratic structure, a new structure in the form of a sort of a community council, a local council. But who is elected in those councils is nothing to do with us, and what those policies that they will enforce or they will encourage is also not something that's in our charter. Effectively, we're just trying to bring the decision-making closer to the people of Waiheke and away from some of these rather obtuse decisions that have been made in the city on our behalf. So we're not going to be able to tell you what's going to happen with your neighbour's fence or what's going to happen with gold cards. But what we can at least say is that, you know, the rates shouldn't go up at the same rate that Auckland City is intending them to go up, and that you will have a greater say in some of these issues that concern you. And that's about as far as we can take it.
So you're gathering up all of these questions now, and some of these, I mean, as you know, I mentioned before, I mean, getting information out of Auckland City or getting a response can be difficult at the best of times. So when you're going and asking questions about how do we break away and do our own thing, then it must be even more difficult to get the answers to these questions that are needed for people to make a judgment about whether this is the way to go or not.
Yeah, there is obviously reluctance. There is obviously commercial reluctance in the first instance. But then, you know, some of the concerns people have expressed that there is the possibility of there being a land grab, as it were. The assets that Auckland City own on Waiheke, if we look like we're breaking away from them, there'll be a garage sale and they'll sell things off. Well, the Local Government Act actually prevents that happening. And I think we're also forgetting as well that it isn't all that long ago that we were an independent council. Back in the 1980s, we were the Waiheke District Council. It was very successful. They showed a great capability of running things on the island and the areas surrounding us. And at the point of amalgamation, we were the only district council that amalgamated into Auckland in the black. Everybody else was in debt. We were in the black. There was money set aside for the wharf. That got swallowed into the consolidated fund, and now we're paying for that again in the wharf tax. So, you know, we've run things in the past, admittedly, on a different Waiheke, but I think now the Waiheke we have today there are more professionals, there are more people, we're better connected. So I don't see that what we're doing is anything unusual, anything strange or anything new.
So one of the things that people talked about repeatedly is the difficulty of finding out just how much money is generated on the island which goes to Auckland City and comparing that to the spend for the island. I mean, is our Waiheke prepared if the... You know, what's the response if it comes back and we find out that actually it's, you know, we're benefiting from that?
Well, I think a good way to look at it, because of the difficulty of separating actual services from overheads and administration costs, it's easy for us to work out how much we're putting into the city council, but it's quite difficult to know what is the value of the money that we're getting back from the city council. And so a good way to look at it is to look at other communities of a similar size with similar problems and see how they're doing and how much money they need. So a lot of work has been done getting the information from local councils like Otorohanga is a good example. There's Gore, there's Stratford, there's Carterton, and a number of towns like that have a similar size population. And if we look at something like Otorohanga, for example, it has five times the road length. that it has to service. It has sewerage systems. It has it has a slightly greater population, a much bigger land area, and it has stormwater. And on top of that, it has a swimming pool. And it manages to do all of that on $11 million, which is roughly half what we have. And this year they had a $2 million surplus. So we can at least see how things can be done through other communities that are working in the same way as us. And from those sort of calculations, you look at it and we really can't see that there is a problem. There are some services we will have to contract out. There are some services we will have to get out of Auckland. But many of the things we'll be able to do locally on the island with local knowledge. And what's more, because we're paying local contractors and local experts, that money is recycled back into the community. It isn't sort of leached out of the community and overseas, as it were.
So as well as the ongoing operating costs of running their own council, there must be significant startup costs in some areas, setting up, the computer and software systems, for example. And we've seen frequently, and with Auckland City itself, the cost of that blow out enormously. What work is going on around costing those initial startup costs? We've got a whole lot of staff who currently are in Auckland. We would need to replicate some of that staff, and have we got the space to do it? What about setting up the computer systems and so on?
That's all being budgeted, and all of that information will be available. We have a website, How a Waiheke. You'll find that on Google. It's all being costed. We estimate that somewhere around 40 staff, and that includes the existing staff that we already have working for us, the council office on the island. So about 40 staff. So that's part of the cost of running a new city council. There will be councillors, somewhere in the region of about 6 councillors, we estimate, because the Waikiki Community Board are a bit overworked. They believe that they need one or two more people to do the work. So, yes, there are concerns and there are obvious things that need to be calculated. But within the budget of what we appear to have, $21-22 million, that actually is easily accommodated. And what's more, there will be our own people living on the island, spending their salaries on the island and making decisions about a place that they know about, a place that they live.
So at the moment, the political environment we have on Waiheke seems to swing dramatically with the electoral cycle. We're getting very, very different direction from this local board than we had from the previous, and it looks like that kind of cycle might continue. Is there a fear that you're going to do all of this and then come, what is it, next October, we have an election and that's it, it's blown out of the water?
There is a possibility that we will not get past stage one, because stage one in the whole process is putting in a proposal to three commissioners that will look at the proposal. They will then consult the public, the affected public, and then they will decide whether we can go ahead or not. So we might not get past stage one. So that's the first thing. The other thing that is really rather bizarre in the early stages, we officially don't need any local support, but we will be seeking that, because it seems rather ridiculous to be making a decision that affects everybody island-wide without asking their opinion. So we will be petitioning the island and asking what the views are of the people on the island. I've lost the thread now. The feistiness of the political situation on Waihi. Yes, and I'm sure it will continue. We're an obstreperous bunch over here, and there will be differences of opinion. But, are we better having those differences of opinion and those bun fights between the different factions? Or are we better just divesting all of that power to some bureaucrats over in the city who we haven't really elected? Not even the councillors over in the city get to know a lot of what's going on over there. So I would say yes, there will be fights, but there will be elections. That's part of a healthy community and a healthy democracy.
So the timeline from here, you're gathering these questions, you're going to spend some... put some work into trying to find answers to some of these, and presumably you need to do that before seeking this public support so that people know what they're getting behind. What's the timeline on all this?
The timeline is that we hope to have everything wrapped up by September or early October, and then a submission will be lodged with the independent commissioners that are supposed to judge the The worthiness of that particular application. And then I think it'll take about another 12 months before a decision is made. There are a lot of start and stop points. There are points that we've got to get past. So it may all be over after the commissioners. We don't know. But then it goes on to the next step, and the next step is that a proposal is put forward by the commissioner, which may be forget the whole idea. It may be accept the idea in full, or some intermediate proposal that the commissioners put forward. And then there is a possibility that somebody can call for a poll that has to be done on 10% of the affected area. Now, 10% of the affected area, again, there's contention about what that means, but that could be Auckland-wide. And the prospect of them getting 10% of Aucklanders to make a decision on this is pretty minimal. So if that fails, then it goes to what the commissioner is saying.
And just going back a step and seeking local support for the initiative, what would you see as a suitable level of support or indication of support to take it forward?
We are hoping to get at least 50%. That means to get people to sign that they support the initial initiative. It'll be very carefully worded. It will. We will probably hire somebody to help us with that poll to make sure that it isn't a double question, or it isn't easily misinterpreted and causes grief. So it will be a very simple single question, and that will be put to the people of Waiheke. They will be allowed to sign online, but we will require signatures and addresses of the Waiheke residents, and it will be carefully scrutinised to make sure there's no errors that are made with it.
All right. So for you at the moment, it's back to trying to find answers to some of these questions.
Well, a lot of the questions have been answered. If you go to the Waiheke webpage, Our Waiheke webpage, there is a Q&A section, and you can ask your own questions. And John Mewson or whoever knows the most about it will be putting answers to those. So, you know, everything's open. There's no skullduggery here. We want to know what people are concerned about. And that also helps us in putting together our proposal, because it preempts what the commissioners might ask.
So what's the address for that website?
You've asked me a difficult... It's our Waiheke, all one word, but you should find it on Google.
I'm just doing that
right now. I can't remember
now
if it's .co.nz or .com or .org.
You might need to boost your search terms.
I think Dan Ballard, who's been doing all of our IT, has actually requested that Google optimise for us. But I think it takes 48 hours, and that was
right.
Only a few days ago.
Yeah, so it's not there yet. All right, well, thank you very much, David. And, you know, look forward to seeing how this progresses. I think that, you know, there'll be a lot more water under the bridge before we reach a conclusion one way or the other.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of fireworks.
Yeah, I'm sure there will. It's David Soul from Our Waiheke. I'll let you know later on once I find that web address. But as I say, you can also go on Facebook and search for Our Waiheke.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio. This is Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. And as it's the first Saturday of the month, we're joined by the opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight.
Good morning.
And Alex Stone.
How are you?
I'm very good. We're just saying before we come on air that way back when we started this feature, which was quite some time ago now, probably five or six years ago.
Yeah.
I think right back at the start of when we got the thing going. One of the reasons we brought you two together was because you used to disagree.
Yeah, what's happened?
Yes.
Yeah, have we all mellowed? I think I've tamed you. I think I've got you.
I think we are getting mellower as we age. But I think also that, I've made no secret of this, and it's something I sort of deal with every day on Facebook, is that whilst I have not... softened my view on my sort of free market views, I do feel that the free market revolution, which I've supported all my adult life, has pushed its luck too far.
Oh, you think it's got there, yeah?
Think, we have reached a point where the tide is going to turn, and I know enough history not to want to be on the wrong side of it.
I must say, for myself, I'm as angry as I ever was.
Oh, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. I always say.
But the political, the sort of mega political situation in New Zealand makes me incredibly angry. So I'm I'm getting grumpier. But that's my life's ambition, to be a curmudgeon. So I hope I'm getting there.
It is a grand thing to be a curmudgeon. You just have to do it with style. Nobody likes a really boring curmudgeon. If you're going to be curmudgeonly, the curmudgeonness, is that a word? It is now.
Yeah, I like it.
It has to be done with a certain style and humour.
Yeah, that's right. There should always be space for humour. And maybe we should laugh at the inadequacies of others.
My inner curmudgeon really came out over Sculpture on the Gulf this year. Of course, you ran away and hid last month while the event was actually happening. But, I wanted to ask you while you were here, a really incredibly low standard this year. Are you proud?
The answer to that is we set up an independent system, because could you imagine if the judging and selecting for Sculpture on the Gulf was done by Waiheke locals? Could you imagine how the story would be? So the selection process is independent.
Independent of what exactly?
Of us.
Discernment, taste.
Well, there's always that possibility, and the judge is also independent of us. And there's always, it's been the history of selected art exhibitions since they began. There's always controversy, and this time there was.
But an extraordinarily low standard of work.
Well,
that won.
Some people. Oh, the one that won.
Yeah, that is completely indefensible. It was ludicrous, and the artist appeared to be mentally ill.
She was a character. Put it that way. Yeah, but I think the work that won was
rubbish.
I would have called it a sort of unrealized undergraduate work.
Yes,
because I've been in the academic art world, and I know that the judge was a professor of art, and the winner was one of his students, and I wasn't very excited about the piece itself. In my terms, it was an unrealized adolescent undergraduate work. But hey, we choose an independent judge, and he makes his independent choice. So the system sometimes works.
Oh, my God. So we even agree on this one. Yeah, we are really losing our edge here. I really was expecting you to defend the indefensible there.
I didn't think it was a great work either. No, I thought there were other works. But there's a whole lot of difficult issues with outdoor sculpture in the country. The popularization of outdoor sculpture shows has seen them tend to become ever more populist and the work ever more accessible. And I don't know if you noticed it, but outdoor sculpture shows seem to be populated more and more by works that are basically visual one-liners, like the dandelion.
The traffic lights.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. And that's it. That's the kind of depth of it. And that's a concern. So an artist that tries something a little deeper and fails,
That's an interesting question, though, isn't it? Because Sculpture on the Gulf is a nationally recognised, very successful outdoor sculpture event.
Yeah.
As you say, there's always that line between high art and garden art.
Yeah.
And as Alan pointed out, and you've acknowledged that you faced some challenges this year around the entries, and I think even last time there were things that turned up that were quite different from what you expected.
Yeah.
So where does Sculpture on the Gulf go with this now?
Well, we think about it all the time. Sculpture in the Gulf was the first of the outdoor sculpture shows in New Zealand, and now they're everywhere. Every little community, it seems, has its out. And some of them are sort of direct competitors for Sculpture in the Gulf, and with greater resources. The North Shore one, for instance, has easier access to a much bigger crowd. And they've gone annual. And they accept a hell of a lot more artists. The North Shore one has 100 works. We think our point of difference is a slightly tighter selection process. So we only have 30 works. One of the works, they have space around them. We also have the issue of the hurdle of the ferry ride. So we got 50,000 visitors this year. The Botanic Gardens a sculpture exhibition gets 150,000 visitors.
Whoa.
So that's the difference of the ferry ride.
Yeah.
And so the exhibition's got its challenges, but it's also got its position at the forefront of this trend, of this fashion, whatever.
Because with a 2-year cycle, you must be looking at commissioning works now.
No, we don't commission works.
Well, I mean, looking for proposals and looking at how this is going to shape up.
Yeah, well, the proposals will...
And then trying to decide which entries are actually by bona fide artists and which are just people who are having a laugh.
Well, the entries come in and we call for entries usually in about May the year before, and the selection's usually done in August the year before. So
right.
It's about a 6-month leading period.
Oh, and who's a deeply disturbed person who's gone off their meds?
Well, artists, you know, there have been a few artists in history that haven't been regular folk. So, it'll probably be a bit of a mission to ask for a clean bill of mental health before you. We might be straying into dangerous territory there. And you've got to keep alive to the possibility of unusual stuff happening.
Well, true. But it's also a huge success with the commercial aspect of it.
Yeah, it was lots of sales, the most sales ever. And I also
I'm talking about the food and drink.
Oh, yeah, there was
maybe
lots
you
of
should
too.
Apply that there as well and serve food and drink that's not to people's taste.
Yeah, we could do insects or something.
Very strange combinations. Yeah.
But I thought there were some triumphs in the artwork. I thought Sharon Montrose's work, the local artist, that she usually does sound work, sound sculpture, and it's usually quite difficult to approach or a bit ethereal or almost impossible to sell. And her work this year, I thought it was a triumph. And it sold, and it was right up there with the People's Choice, which is an extraordinary collection of things for a sound work. And given the trend, as I said earlier, with sculpture becoming ever more accessible and one-liner-ish, and Sharon's work was very deep and very profound. I also have to acknowledge her co-artist in the work. I'm having a senior moment, but... think of it a moment. A composer, Helen Bowater. She composed the soundscape, and together I thought they did a fantastic work. Yeah.
So I mean, as the arty farty one amongst us, I mean, you've told us what you didn't like. You told us one. I mean, what were the other pieces that you thought did stand up?
I thought the James Bond one was an excellent work because it was very accessible, very easy to grasp, very sort of easy on the eye, very kind of smooth, and you know, it fitted in all the. In the heritage of pop art, it was bang on pop art, and it had a lovely dual irony about, you know, the whole selfie culture going back to the original James Bond, who was pre-selfie. You know, so the fact we had Sean Connery as James Bond photographing himself with his cell phone is a nice irony. And one of the interesting things that came of that is that piece was sold, and a second piece was commissioned where the buyers wanted the same piece but the new James Bond. They wanted the blonde one, Daniel Craig. They wanted her to do the same piece but with Daniel Craig.
Clever.
It wouldn't have worked because the irony was it was Sean Connery prior to selfie culture. You know, it was the beginning of celebrity culture. But
I think
to
that when
culture.
You're paying $60,000 for a sculpture, the customer's always right.
Yes, right. I don't think the artist quibbled. She said, "Yeah, I'll make you another one,
whatever you want, that sort of price."
And she sold quite a few works through the Pavilion Gallery as well. So she had a very successful show. She's a local Anna Dunshi. She's a local artist. So yeah, no, I thought it was good. Yeah, and I thought it was wonderful that the People's Choice went to what was a very accessible work and a very wonderful artist character. I don't know if you ever met James Wright. He was a terrific character, real salt of the earth.
So that was the target, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, all things considered, you get your misses and near misses and confusing pieces, and it's just how it is, you know. I think if we were to shut down the show because there were some works that Alan didn't like, we'd be in, you ain't the thought police just yet. I think we're perfectly welcome to discuss the works and say which ones we'd liked and didn't like, you know. Yeah.
But and that is interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes you do get the feel that there is this kind of defending the indefensible with it. Some of that, you know, if you look at the catalogue and the way that the pieces are spoken about in these kind of reverential tones, it does feel like there's a fear of criticism.
But I think we've got to accept that humour is a big part of art. And in the past, there has been... There probably was more humour in previous shows. I remember the Bare Bottom Guys and things. There was a bit more humour, perhaps, in previous shows. But so be it. You know, you get things come and go.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe, you know, I'm of the opinion that generally this country's losing its sense of tolerance and humour. And as I said earlier, I'm really grumpy about our loss of morality in our sort of in our national consciousness with the acceptance of our venal leadership, and maybe artwork in this country will start reflecting that kind of grumpiness. Yeah, you know what's happening now is the Prime Minister can't be seen in public because he gets heckled and jostled, and he gets hustled out the back because, you know, fears of unsightly protest. There's a mood of anger moving up in the country, and maybe the art.
About time too.
Yeah. So, and art often precedes these things. So maybe there was no humour in the art this year because there was underlying mood of anger. But I thought there were still delightful works. Sorry, we're sort of mixing metaphors here. But there were delightful works in the sculpture. The one with the stars, the black buckets and the stars, I thought was lovely. Did you see that one?
No.
I didn't actually go and look.
So you're criticising something you didn't see.
I've been around the thing a couple of times before, and I always come away from it so angry that, no, it just doesn't do me any good. I'll end up finding one of the artists and punching them, and it would all just be awful, so I just stay away.
No, you must accept there's different kinds of art that we like and others that we don't, and it's just all part of the rich tapestry. I mean, you're into art. You're into folk music and Shakespeare and a whole spread of art. Speaking of which, the local Shakespeare production, that is bloody brilliant.
Courtyard. Yes, I'm involved in the Shakespeare thing, because one of the main reasons I said yes to a role in it was that there is that beautiful new courtyard space, all there for outdoor theatre. My God, it works!
Yeah,
my concern when I first looked at it, when they opened up the whole space to the public. Was that, you know, when you try and do outdoor theatre, you do always have this thing that there are certain rules to outdoor theatre. The traffic will increase. The airport will suddenly reroute all its planes overhead and large flocks of incontinent seagulls will appear. But none of these things have happened. Yeah. And it is quite incredible how that library building seems to just absorb all the sound of the buses and cars going past.
Yeah, you've also been lucky with no blizzards or thunderstorms.
Oh, well, we were forced inside last night.
Oh, well, that's right. Yeah.
And tonight looks grim.
But you know...
Tonight looks grim too, so it will be indoors.
I think that it's just the most magical performance. What I think is amazing is how the young lovers are perfectly cast in finding teenagers from the island.
They are so amazingly young.
Yeah they're just good. And then to mix them with incredible professional actors, the mechanicals, every one of them are just brilliant. So that mix of these young actors willing to do Shakespeare and the old thespians on the island, this intermixing of them is just fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty magical.
I had an interesting comparative exercise. I went to the university. They're doing Midsummer Night's Dream as well. And I went 2 days later. That had been a Christmas present, so we'd booked those tickets before we even knew about the Waiheke show. We stood up. I reckon we were better. Some of our characters were better. Our Puck was definitely better. Our Helena was better. Our Oberon was better, you know. I thought I think it was the best damn thing.
Oh, that's good to know. Still two more performances to go.
Yeah.
So what have you got? You got tonight?
We've got tonight and tomorrow night. I'd say we will almost certainly be in the theatre tonight, but hopefully by tomorrow we'll be back outside.
Yeah, it's a pity to be inside because the staging of it was so expansive outside, you know, the way
being able to use bicycles and skateboards and things like that. Yeah, it really does.
Fantastic. I think Cindy Peterkin did a fantastic job. So if there's anyone out there listening who hasn't seen the show, you got to go and see it. It's I think it's the start of a fantastic new tradition.
Yeah.
And, you know, can build on Waiheke's strength. Did you hear about Billy Jordan getting the local hero of New Zealand Award? There you go. That's us. Interesting thing is the university production of Midsummer Night's Dream, their fairies were all in their 80s. And those fairies were channeling our hip-hop operation. It looked like the same energy, the same... Looked like they stole our idea, you know?
Ah, yes. So. We did that actually a few years ago. We did Midsummer Night's Dream, and I think it was 2007.
Yeah.
We had the idea of the changeling child, yeah. Was played by a very elderly lady. The idea that the fairies, being immortal,
yeah.
you know, pick up human playthings and don't realise that they only last a little while.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we had this incredibly old lady in a school uniform.
Yeah, I thought our puck was especially ageless and timeless and fantastic, whereas the university puck was... It wasn't as good, yeah. So sorry about naming act. I think they were just great. It's a fantastic thing. Yeah.
Hey, moving along, I got here early enough to hear your previous discussion with David Saul. I was interested, I mean, obviously it's a very interesting topic anyway, the whole our Waiheke thing and the idea of the breakaway from the super city, which has been a disaster. And we were talking about this last month, of course, that, you know, despite the comments online of a certain disaffected previous local board member, you'd have to say that John Mewson has actually picked up on something that's got to be worth looking at.
Yeah, when John first started, he mentioned this idea to me months ago, and I said, John, this could be a tricky one. Why don't you bed into the local community, get re-elected, and then try it? And he's barreled ahead. But what's interesting is it's a campaign that's getting support from right across the political spectrum. I just to stay informed, I read just about everything, and I read a very persuasive article on an ACT Party website the other day against these big amalgamations, you know, so you get people from right across the political spectrum questioning this super city deal. And one of the things we all say about the super city is, where's the proof it's working? You know, what's the
proof? God, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we were talking before we came on about the dog consultation.
Oh, that's a disaster.
Yeah. Why do we always feel like when they do decide to do what they call consultation, you've always got those ironic apostrophes around the word. They're not really consulting us.
Well,
they're just
wrote
putting
that,
the appearance of it, and then they will go away and do what they always had planned.
Well, I love surveys. I just love responding to surveys, maybe because I think someone's taken an interest in what I think.
There is a sort of a touching, somebody cares.
Someone cares, yeah. But whoever wrote that dog survey knows nothing about Waiheke. So how can someone be so uninformed to write a survey? It's got to be a failure, because the biggest issue with dogs on the island last year was the misinformation of the Stop the Marine Reserve campaign, who said dogs won't be allowed on beaches, and they ran this whole campaign bullshitting people that this was a fact. So a lot of people are confused about dogs on beaches. This was the biggest dog issue on Waiheke last year, and this survey misses it completely.
Well, yes. I mean, how do you feel about, you know, all the very many attacks on fish by dogs? I mean, you know, happens a lot. There's a fish minding its own business. A dog comes along and savages it. It happens all the time.
Actually, I was down at Oropew Wharf at dawn this morning, and there was a kingie with its fin out the water in shallow water, and the dogs paid no attention to the kingfish. It was like in a different realm. So they can live happily side by side.
I used to have a dog that reacted a lot to dolphins.
Yeah.
If there were dolphins out there, he'd sort of get quite agitated and run up and down the beach and get excited.
Oh, we'd have to
ban. He never went and did anything about it.
Yeah. Raised a petition or whatever. But that dog survey was a heap of rubbish. What bugged me about it is that it was predicated from the position that dogs are bad. And whatever we have to do, we have to control dogs. So you answering it as a dog owner felt kind of defensive right from the start.
Yeah.
And the other issue they missed completely is the problem with dogs in an urban situation or on the beaches in a park. It's not the problem ain't dogs. It's certain breeds of dogs and irresponsible ownership of dogs. So it's not a blanket problem. It's a much more specific problem. And also a tiny problem, given the, you know, how many teenagers in this country die of suicide a year, and one or two get one or two kids get bitten. It's a minor problem, and we turn it into this big drama. And
yes, definite lack of perspective. On a lot of the problems.
But that survey will be less than useless because it does not address the central issue with dogs on the island, which was raised last year. That needs to be clarified, and that survey was a perfect situation to get some clarity about this situation. You know, so I'm a bit grumpy about that one.
Yeah.
And dogs are part of our lives. You know, they wonderful critters. You know, and if we want to be at all in tune with nature, the first place to start is the animal that's closest to us in history. So, you know, if children can't relate to the body language of a dog, we've got a long way to go to understanding nature. You know, and 99% of dogs on this beach, on Waiheke beaches, are friendly. They come up to you and they wave and they say hello.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? Yay.
Well, I went to the market this morning trying to find the person with the survey, but was unsuccessful.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
well, because the person who wrote the survey is some urbanite 30-something bureaucrat sitting in a neon-lit office in the super city in town. There's nobody there. Now, if John Mewson's approach went ahead and we had a borough council, there would be some local who would have written that survey.
Mm.
Yes. So I think we should go ahead with this Waiheke Goes Alone routine.
I think, you know, one of the things I was going to question about your discussion with David Saul was that you agreed on the idea that the political scene is going to sort of move backwards and forwards between right and left. I found myself questioning that when you were saying it. Do you really think it is?
You mean on Waiheke?
Because, yes, the previous board ended up with a fairly broad right-wing lean to it. But that was a fluke, let's not forget.
Well, I suppose what we've seen over the, you know, the last few elections is that, you know, once you've got three, then, you know, you rule the roost. Yeah. So there is at least the potential for quite dramatic swings in direction.
Do you think there is? I'm not sure that's entirely true. No. Because the, you know, the previous right-leaning board, when you looked at the figures, they really only had 30% support.
Yeah.
If they chose to behave like they had something like 80% support, well, more fool them, as it proved. Mm. You know, if you suddenly start doing this, going down that kind of third world dictator track, yeah, and going, I am the father of my people, just because you got voted in on a fluke.
Yeah, but I go with Chris's point too. I think there will be a lot of money invested in more right-leaning candidates in the next election. There is money on this island, and there are people prepared to put that money there. And I'd put a firm prediction that there will be a lot of money spent on right-leaning candidates to oust the current board, which has a much more of an environmental perspective.
These people, you see, this is the problem. And you know, I feel for the rich on this island. It must be terrible to know that come election time that your vote is worth exactly the same as everybody else.
No, it's not. It's not. It's worth disproportionately more because the all of the heritage of local government voting, all of the records show that all of the analysis shows that the people more likely to vote are elderly, financially secure, and that comes with its own bias. And it's happening nationwide.
We're talking about Waiheke here.
Yeah, but even so, we didn't have 100% turnout, and within our turnout, those more likely to vote are elderly, financially secure. It's just how it is in all elections. And it's a worrying trend. I heard of some very interesting research on a nationwide scale. You know, there was a lot of discussion last election, where were the missing 100,000 voters? Where were they? Who were they? And I've came across a young woman starting a PhD, and her early results show that in Northland, the missing voters are people really struggling financially, and they're afraid of going on the voters' roll because they know that then credit companies will chase them for outstanding bills.
Oh, that's a nasty thought.
So where does that lead us? That leads us to the point where only people who are financially secure can vote, and that leads us to some kind of oligarchy, is that the word?
Oligarchy.
Yeah. And only the rich guys vote. A dangerous trend. Yeah, and, you know, it might be happening just in a kind of informal way in other local government bodies, but if it's happening on a – They said this woman's early results showed it was the most significant hurdle to enrollment. Was fear.
And there's been some interesting stuff in the United States and various states where it's taken to a formal process with, you know, putting barriers in front of, you know, about addresses and so on in front of voter registration. So, there was an interesting thing on some Green MP, a Green Party supporter, someone posted a little while ago, you know, railing against John Key and saying, oh, he's only acting for these people. What about the homeless and the single parents and stuff like that? You know, they're voters too. And well, that's the problem. They're not.
They are.
Who brought his phone into the studio? Take it out.
Andy doesn't know how to work it. What's the point of having the phone if you don't know how to answer it, Alex?
I know. Well, I can't answer in the middle of the radio. We'll phone him back.
Oh, I don't know. I came in one morning. Sharon Brown was in here. She said, would I come in and talk about something or other? And so we're chatting away, and her phone goes, and she wandered off out of the studio. And,
left you to it.
Yeah, one of her kids was calling, and I had to sort of sit here and keep talking like I was still had Shireen across the desk, sort of nodding at me.
Well, I'm glad you guys did keep talking while the phone was ringing. Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, that's the good thing about having
you, local politics.
You two on, you entertain yourselves, and I can go make a cup of coffee.
Yeah, but I think Alan's point needs fleshing out. I think I think there will be a right wing backlash in the next local body election, and I think John and Paul and Co need to. John needs to make progress on the old
succession. I disagree. I don't think that right-wing backlash will have any kind of force to it, given quite how disastrously the previous right-wing board worked.
No, that doesn't stack up historically, because given how disastrously the right-wing did under Bill English, they got themselves organized, and the whole dirty politics story is the result. A similar thing could happen here. They won't lie down and they won't just say, oh, we lost, we're forever lost. They're going to get themselves organized to try and get back into
power. Well, obviously we will be all over this when it happens. I'm inclined to think that the, whatever there was in terms of a right-wing power block on this island, they
don't
have done themselves a lot of damage,
don't
and their
the
chances
tense.
Of getting back are not good.
Don't talk in the past tense, because they've got power.
I speak as a right wing person. I think the right have reached a point where there will be the backlashes against them.
Yeah, well,
we saw, of course, this week the delightful Gina Reinhart telling us that people should be glad to work for $2 an hour.
Yeah, yeah, or the zero-hour contract.
Yes, and I've just found myself thinking, does the name Marie Antoinette mean anything to you? Because you really might want to moderate your comments, or you're going to find a way to meet her.
Yes. But how stupid are we? You know, I'm just trying to pen some writing thoughts about, as a nation, trying to pen an article along the lines of, as a nation, which shower did we come down on? How do we fall for such shit? Because these zero-hour contracts, they're basically just a scam to amend the employment figures. Because if you sign a zero-hour contract, that means you're employed.
Even though they don't give you any work.
Yeah. You've just signed this thing. They said you might have some work in some month. So you suddenly off the unemployment stats. So it suddenly looks very nice. Mm. We are just so naive that we buy this shit, you know. And the examples are legion. And so on Waiheke, I'm quite pleased that we've got something of a progressive local board, you know, with environmental perspectives on our future and so on, and John doing some clever thinking about where we can stand and pay our own way. I think it's all good stuff. I see it as progressive stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did manage to get you two disagreeing this month, which was
there. We got there in the end.
We did. So we'll call it quits there. Thank you very much to Alan Knight and Alex Stone, our opinionated Islanders, who will be back with us the first Saturday of next month. Although I think that might be Easter.
Yeah.
Oh, it probably is. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I'm going out to check out the Third World. So I'll be able to report back on how the Third World's doing.
Oh, when are you going to the Third World?
At Easter. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
To Africa. So we'll see you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, only parts of Africa are the Third World.
Some are Second World.
Or some are all of the worlds together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Have you ever wondered where the Second World is.
I know exactly where it is.
Where is it?
I've often wondered about this because, you know, it used to be that the Second World was sort of the communist bloc.
Yeah.
But with the end of that, it always seems to me that Second World, to me nowadays, means countries that have the potential to achieve a First World lifestyle but are held back usually by religion. It's countries, well, like Saudi Arabia, for example. Yeah. You couldn't call it a First World country. It has no free press. Yeah. They still have the death penalty.
Yeah. But they
so
are
it's countries that they just can't let go of certain old-fashioned,
that's
unpleasant
an interesting definition.
Ideas.
Because the real definition of this, it goes new world, old world, new world, third world. That's the real definition. That's where the expression third world comes from. There's the old world, Europe.
Well, when you get back, you can tell us if you've found it.
Yeah.
The Second World.
Yeah. Yeah. Why Talks is a new initiative on the island, bringing together a series of speakers to talk on a common theme. There are four events planned for 2015 on the theme of inspiration. It's been broken down into four topics: love, laughter, light, and land. The first evening of talks was held at Palm Beach Hall on the 28th of February with eight speakers talking on the theme of love. They all chose a different tack, and Waiheke Radio has recorded all of them and will be making them available for podcast. But I'm going to feature one here now, which is Paul Bond talking about how love is portrayed in song.
Good evening. I can hear her heartbeat from 1,000 miles, and the heavens open every time she smiles. And I'll come to her, that's where I belong. Yeah, and I'm running to her like a river strong. She give me love, 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 crazy love. She give me love, 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 crazy love. She's got a fine sense of humor when I'm feeling low down. And when I come to her, when the sun goes down, she takes away my heartaches, she takes away my grief, she takes away my troubles in the night just like a thief. And gives me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. And I need her in the daytime, and I need her in the night, and I want to throw my arms around her and kiss and hug her, kiss and hug her tight, yeah. Because when I'm returning from so far away, she gave me some sweet lovin' to brighten up my day. And it makes me righteous, and it makes me whole, and it makes me mellow down to my soul. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. Thank you. I find that bit easier than the talking bit. We'll give it a go anyway. When I was first asked to participate in the Why Talks, and the subject, of course, being love, I said yes immediately. And then you think to yourself, why did I do that? Because I had a few wines, okay, that's probably part of it, but
you think of a medium in which you're going to express yourself. And for me, I hold to the belief that there's really two great loves in life. There's lots more than that, but there's two kind of great bedrock ones from which is the best possible start. And that is family, of course, and with that comes love of yourself, because that's your identity. And if you're lucky enough along the way, the love of a partner. And to me, it's interesting to speak about love, because I have to be honest, I've always been a little bit uncomfortable speaking about love in any great length. And I have been always a little suspicious of people who speak a lot about it. Because I've known plenty of people in my life that the word love is not really in their vocabulary as such. But they're full of love. They love all the time. But it's just they don't say it so much. But that doesn't in any way detract from the amount they love or how they love and whatever. So but the name of the game is why talk. So you gotta talk it up whether you're comfortable with it or not. I have to be honest, I don't think I could do justice to the really huge events in your emotional life. I mean, I think of like the death of my father, meeting the love of my life, or the birth of the children. And 9 minutes or, you know, 90 minutes, I really couldn't do justice to those events in the context of trying to express to you the feelings, the love at the time, and the loss. But to me, as I said, those two forms of love, that family love, that's a non-negotiable almost. The other ones, I think some people believe that there is an absolute one true partner or one love in your life, and that's all there is. I think there's plenty of evidence to the contrary that there's more than one love. That may be for you, it may not, but if you lose one, that's not to say there isn't one more out there somewhere, I'm sure of it. So, the medium I'm going through is song, because that's what I'm most comfortable with. I mean, Van Morrison, he speaks of inarticulate speech of the heart, and to me that says more about how I might express myself than others do. I think the deeper you feel, the more you feel, the harder it is to say. It doesn't get easier to say, it doesn't get easier to explain. So I thought about all the poets and the storytellers, the movie makers, and then I settled on the medium of song because it's one I've been the most comfortable with. And I suppose when I say song, I mean principally the lyrics. So for family love, I thought to myself, well, the Finn brothers sing about family love and a sense of belonging, and they tell us that they'll try to explain but probably get it all wrong, but it means that I won't give in. It's a very simple lyric, but it's fantastically, it explains what to me what family love is that you just don't give in. That's it. You go the whole distance, and that's what I've been lucky enough to be blessed with in my life, and I have always felt sympathy for people who don't feel that they have that, or for some reason didn't quite get the start that they might have been able to carry on through. Because I think if you have it as a start, you're ahead of the game. If you don't have it and you have to create it, well, that's an uphill battle, I think, for a lot of people anyway. And of course, another one which always comes to mind to me is again, in song, is the very bleak lament to fractured family love from Bruce Springsteen that states that nothing feels better than blood on blood. But of course, when nothing feels better, once it's lost, nothing can replace it. And that's in that song, he covers that topic particularly well. So kind of falling in love and finding a partner is the beginning of that kind of love found, lost, found cycle. And, you know, it's how many turns you get on that may not depend on you. It may well be that somebody else decides when you begin and when you stop. So I tend to look at it that once it starts to happen, it changes the story of your life. Some people would say not always for the better, but it does change the story of your life and begin to define you as a, if you're in love or in a partnership, you as part of something rather than on your own. So as I say, some people hold to that belief that there's one, but I believe, you know, there's always more chances out there for people. I've always kind of felt sorry in lyrics for somebody like some Roxy Music song Dance Away. The character says, I walked you home, we kissed goodnight. I said it's love, you said all right. I mean, it's not the response you're hoping for, but but we've all been there, I suppose. And for me, the great songs pull you in. You don't as such have to learn them. You identify with the character, and then if the story unfolds. That's the nature of, that's why, I suppose, in the intro, the ballad tradition. That's what the ballad tradition does, and the way you go. So I'm getting the sign now. So I was going to sign off with just one little more song, but I would like to say just before I go is that it's my mother's birthday today, and her take on it was always, in the end, it's just kindness. That's all that matters, kindness. All the rest will fall into place. So this is just a little bit from her favorite song and one of mine too, and it is "And I Love You So." Okay? And yes, I know how lonely life can be. The shadows follow me and the night won't set me free. But I won't let the evenings get me down. Not now that you're around me. Thanks.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onewarua.